Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Gyms are closed and social distancing orders have ruled out team sports, leaving most of us, that is those without home gyms, to walking, running, and biking. That dearth of fitness choices might inspire some to abandon exercise goals, and that would be a mistake. Regular exercise supports the immune system, and it's a potent stress reliever. Dr. Tamara Hugh Butler is an associate professor of exercise and sports science at Wayne State University, and she specializes in hydration as well as athlete performance. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
And Dr. Marianne Fallman, a professor of health education also at Wayne State, has studied the impact of exercise on immune function for the last 20 years. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So you both wrote about exercise and immunity for the conversation, and we'll post a link to that article on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. What is the relationship between exercise and immunity, Marianne Fallman?
Okay, so the shortest answer I can give you is there's a sweet spot. So picture a J. You have a J in your mind?
Mm-hmm.
At the bottom of that J is no exercise, and at the top of that J is like a whole lot of exercise. And in the middle of the J, that's the sweet spot, just a minimal amount of exercise that helps to protect you. So anything over 2 hours or any exercise to exhaustion, we did studies where we exercised people to exhaustion in 30 seconds and decreased their immune function. So nothing to exhaustion, nothing over 2 hours, and then the sweet spot is somewhere between 30 and 50 minutes at a normal rate where you can talk while you're exercising.
Why is that while you can? I mean, I do boot camps, and so I'm definitely going through withdrawal. You know, I like that group. I like that group activity. I like to be exhausted, but safely, you know, where you're certainly encouraged to stop if you can't, you know, if you're having trouble breathing or something. But what, so not everyone understands what exhaustion is.
Well, that you're right, because a marathon is considered exhaustion. So
okay.
it's an activity like beyond. So you're doing boot camp. So you're probably in your very, very high exercise level. Tammy can talk about the anaerobic threshold, but you stop after 30 minutes, right?
Right. 45, but yeah.
Yeah. And then do you do it every single day or do you take a day off?
I usually do it 4 times a week.
Okay, so but that's not Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday,
no.
Right? It's
no.
Monday, Wednesday. Yeah. Okay, you're fine. You'll be fine.
Okay,
you're fine.
But I'm not doing it now. That's what's killing me. And and Tamara Hugh Butler, before we move on, I have a million questions, but there is the mental health piece of all of this, right?
Absolutely. You know, so people always talk about the physical benefits, you know, cardiovascular, the muscle strength, but a lot of times the mental health gets thrown the window, but there's been so many studies in it that show that exercise is good for like depression, anxiety, because there are some mood altering drugs that are actually released by your body into your brain related to like dopamine or opioids or even like some substances that are like marijuana. And so you get this internal drug high from exercise that actually keeps your, reduces anxiety. You know, you feel elation. So that actually, that makes you feel better.
Yeah, I definitely get that. And just walking even 3 or 4 miles is not doing it for me. You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. You just heard from Tamara Hugh Butler. She's an associate professor of exercise and sports science at Wayne State University in Detroit. Also with us, Marianne Fallman. She's a professor of kinesiology, health and sports studies at Wayne State. If you have a question or comment, we're talking about exercise, the benefits to our immune system, the drawbacks to our immune system if you overdo it, the benefits to your well-being, your health and well-being in general. So if you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. What have previous epidemics or pandemics taught us about exercise, Marianne Fallman?
Okay, so this all started in 1940 with the polio epidemic. And what they found was that if you did nothing when the symptoms first began, you went to bed, then 80% of those people made a full recovery. Well, people who continued with their normal activity, I'm not even talking exercise, mm-hmm. although in the 1940s, normal activity was probably exercise, 60% of those people had severe paralysis.
Wow. I mean, is that a direct line or that's a correlation? Do we know about what that chemical causation was?
No, in the 1940s, they weren't even doing this research. And so they just noticed that that happened. We didn't have any of the cellular or mucosal immune measures back then. It just wasn't being done.
Right. And Tamara Hugh Butler, what are the signals to your body? I mean, what is your, I guess it's different for different people, but in general, what kind of signals is your body sending you when they say it's too much or, yeah, you actually are sick, you shouldn't be here?
Well, again, to going to your last point, if you have any symptoms, you do not exercise. Oh. I mean, full stop. You can actually make everything worse because you start this inflammatory response, your organs can get inflamed, and that's a bad situation. So again, too, if you have any symptoms, you do not exercise. But before that, so what are the symptoms of, like, you're maybe doing too much? I think if you have pain, you know, usually when you exercise a little bit, you know, you'll get a little bit of out of breath, like we talked about, or a little bit of discomfort, but that should go away within, like, a minute or a few seconds of you stopping. And that's okay. But if it doesn't go away within, like, 60 seconds, you know, I think you're doing a little bit too much. And again, too, what is the sweet spot differs for everybody. Yeah. If you don't do anything, you know, walking three times a week or like something very light would be good for you. But for people like Marianne who goes out or me who runs every day, you know, so we can probably do a little bit more because we're used to it. So again, too, it's a big spectrum. But again, too, anything pain that doesn't go away once you stop, I think is a bad warning sign. But any type of symptoms, you actually don't want to start an exercise routine.
You have conducted, and I think it's Marianne Fallman, but maybe you guys did this together. You've conducted research on college football and cross country athletes.
Yeah,
that was Marianne.
Yeah, Marianne, what did that tell you?
Well, we actually watched them across the whole year. So we watched them during periods of intense training, periods where they barely trained, they were just doing their events, and then periods where they were semi off. And what we found was the more intense they exercised, the more their immune function decreased and the more likely they were to get upper respiratory tract infections. At one point during the season, 80% of our football players had upper respiratory tract infections.
What are you looking at when you're measuring immune strength?
Well, you can look at a lot of things, but what I'm looking at, upper respiratory tract infection, I'm looking for a chemical that's in your saliva and your mucous membranes called immunoglobulin A. And then I'm looking at how much is in your mouth because that's the part that's likely to be able to trap viruses.
Is there a hypothesis in here about the COVID-19 virus in that,
yeah,
that, you know, that maybe we're all better off slowing down a little bit right now and preserving our immune health?
Well, I've been trying to follow the research out of China and Europe because they're farther ahead on this than we are.
Okay.
And it does seem to bind to a chemical on the tongue. But what I have not been able to find is what the immune response to that is. So that's just not out there yet. I mean, okay. I've probably read like 25 studies out of China in the last week alone.
Wow. Let's see.
Say, yes, you should slow down right now just to protect your immune system. You should. I'm not saying to stop exercising, but limit your severe exercise. Huh. And also, of course, watch your diet.
Yeah. We're going to be talking about that this week. Kent in Ashland, you're on the air. Hi, Kent.
Oh, hi.
Go
is this
ahead.
Ann?
Yeah.
Oh, hey, Ann. Your show is incredible.
Thanks, Kent.
And I just love watching your shows.
Thank you.
But I wanted to hear what the ladies had to say about silver sneakers.
So what is silver sneakers?
And I really love it. Now we can't even go.
Why? Is it in the malls or something? where you walk?
Oh, in my town, it's at the YMCA.
Okay. All right. So a lot of people who need to be doing this indoors aren't able to do it. The malls are closed down. The rec centers are closed down. Any suggestions, Tamara Hubeller?
I'm not sure what silver sneakers are, but again, if you can go out, you know, even if you're under lockdown, at least in Michigan, they allow you to go outside and walk and or jog. But you just have to still maintain that social distance. Stay at least 6 feet away from the next nearest person. But again, too, you know, going outside instead of in the mall, you won't be able to get too close to your friends. But again, too, that'll probably make you feel better. And Marianne probably can offer a little bit more advice there.
Yeah, Marianne?
Yeah, no, I say the same thing. I'm out every single day, and I see the same walkers every single day, but now we distance. You can still talk to somebody from 6 feet, but we don't ever stand together anymore. We can't even pet dogs.
You know, though, the I think that, really, you can't even pet dogs? Woo.
Well, no, not unless they have a six-foot leash from their owner.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah. Right. I think Silver Sneakers, it's a seniors walking program, and it's mostly in rec centers, but it's indoors, and it's for them, I suppose, it's safer. You don't have curb cuts and, I walk on mulch, but someone else might not be able to. But Kent, thanks for that call. Try to keep walking, though. But a lot of exercise, at least in our generation and in our lifetime, has become social. It's a social thing. And I wonder how much of that goes to that mental health piece, Tamara.
Probably. And again, too, I think Marianne and I have also had these discussions, like, you know, if you're an extrovert and you really feed upon social interaction, it's very, very difficult. You know, me, I'm an introvert, so it's okay. But again, too, I think now, especially with the age of social media, you just have to find different ways to connect. So again, too, it's not that we can't do things, but we just have to do things differently. So I think that's what a lot of the kids are starting to do, at least in the college level, you know, just like having chats and Zooms and, you know, what'd you do? So I think that's where we need to go just to maintain the social interaction as well as maintain our commitment to some type of activity.
Are you seeing more people outside?
Well, where I am, I'm in the rural farmlands, so I never see anybody outside at the times. So Marianne can probably, she probably walks.
You live in the city?
I live in a city, not the city of Detroit. I'm outside of Detroit, but I'm definitely not rural. And yes, I see a lot. I'm actually had been walking inside for most of February with the Silver Sneakers group. I moved. I know, it's free. I moved outside, and we had snow on Sunday, and I still had to walk outside. But, you know, it is what it is. So.
Yeah, right.
Not giving it up.
Yeah. Someone joked on our Facebook page for our neighborhood, do you notice a lot of strangers walking up and down the street these days?
Yeah.
But it is kind of nice to see everybody out together, families, you know.
Yeah, they say there's a boom in, like, some of the running just because they don't have anything to do.
Right. I can't wait to get my bike out. You know, I'm hoping it gets warm enough in the next week, you know, next couple of days, actually, to get the bike out and do that. Well, Tamara Hubeller and Marianne Fallman, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your insights.
You're welcome. Stay safe out there.
Stay safe. Marianne Fallman is a professor of kinesiology, health, and sports studies at Wayne State University in Detroit. Tamara Hubeller is an associate professor of exercise and sports science at Wayne State as well. And they have written an article about exercise and immunity and mental well-being for The Conversation. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/All Sides. This is All Sides. This is Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We have been talking about exercise and what it brings to your life. And right now I have a free segment. My guest is not here yet, and I wanted to hear from callers about... Okay, I guess he is here. So the American Red Cross is facing an unprecedented blood shortage after thousands of blood drives across the country were canceled to stem the spread of the coronavirus. Hospitals are gearing up, though, for a surge in patients from the same virus. Rodney Wilson is communications manager for the American Red Cross in Central Ohio. Welcome to the show. Hi, Rodney. Hi, Rodney. Are you there?
I am here. Do you hear me?
Yes, I do. Thanks. So welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
How many blood drives have been canceled as a result of COVID-19?
Well, the numbers are quite staggering. If you look across the country, just in the past 2 weeks or so, more than 7,000 blood drives have been canceled. And that represents about 200,000 blood donations across the country. Here locally in the state of Ohio, we're looking at more than 700 blood drives, which equates to about 22,000 blood donations. So it's staggering numbers. We've not seen anything like this before.
Ever before?
No. You know, I've been with the Red Cross for about 17 years, and usually when we have a lot of cancellations, it's when we have a really bad winter, and maybe there's snowstorms that hit us for multiple days, and a lot of blood drives cancel, and that may last for a couple of days. We've never seen blood drives in this volume for an extended period of time canceling like this. So when we have these blood drives that we're planning for not available for us to collect the blood, that will compromise our ability to provide the blood to hospitals.
This is a function, so even like at 9/11, even in other times of catastrophe, we didn't have to have the social distancing we have now.
Right, yeah, that's another challenge that we have right now. So we have significantly fewer blood drives. And the blood drives that we continue to have and operate, we've implemented additional safety measures in terms of coronavirus. So if you've gone to a blood drive before and you go to a blood drive now, you're going to see things are a little different.
How so?
We're doing some things like we're checking temperatures before you even enter the blood drive to make sure that you don't have a temperature. That includes our own staff and volunteers. In addition to the donors, we're using hand sanitizer throughout the process multiple times. Our staff members, of course, wear gloves and change the gloves between each donor. We're wiping down every donor touch point throughout the process between donors. And we've implemented social distancing at the blood drives as well. So where you sit, where the blood donor beds are, and the health history stations are all spaced further apart than you would typically see.
What kind of shape was the blood supply in before the COVID-19 issue?
Yeah, that's a good question. We came off of a low blood collections time over the winter. Winter is typically a lower blood collections time. People just don't like to go out when it's a little colder. It wasn't a really bad winter for us, but it's still blood donations were down. So the inventory was below, what we consider sufficient levels before coronavirus came into play. And the fact that we had, more than 7,000 blood drives cancel in a two-week period is just exacerbating the issue and creating really quite a severe shortage.
Have you gotten any direction from the state, which has ordered people to stay home?
Yeah. So the Red Cross has worked with national agencies and state agencies to ensure that blood drives continue and that people can continue to donate blood. So a strong blood supply is considered part of a community's emergency response preparedness. So hospitals can't perform medical procedures and take care of patients if they don't have the blood supply available to them. So even in a time like this, the Red Cross and blood drives are categorized as an essential service. So that means it must continue, and that people are allowed to travel to blood drives and are encouraged to do that during this period, even when they're being asked to stay at home. Blood drives are a safe, clean, sterile place for them to go.
But there aren't a lot of blood drives out there right now. How should people find out where to go? Just go to the American Red Cross in Central Ohio's website?
Yeah, that's really the best place right now. Typically, at the beginning of each month, we make a list of all the blood drives coming up over the next month, and we share that out with media so everybody can see, here's the list. But what we're seeing right now is it's changing every day. Life is kind of changing for everyone a little bit every day right now. So we're seeing more and more blood drives cancel every single day. Mm. So we're not really able to provide a list. But you can find the most current list online. If you go to redcrossblood.org, you can search for blood drives by your zip code and by a date range that's convenient for you. And that list is always updated in real time, so you know that anything that's listed there is not canceled.
When there's a shortage, there's always a shortage of some things more than others. Was it O positive, or is there some kind of blood type that is in particular need?
Well, right now we really have an urgent need for all types.
Okay.
It's kind of a unique situation, and just by the volume of blood drives canceling, it means all blood donations are down. In general, hospitals use type O the most because it's universal. That means it can go to trauma patients. Right now, as hospitals are looking at what's happening with coronavirus and preparing for possible influx of patients, many hospitals are postponing elective surgeries. So those are some surgeries that might need blood products to happen, such as hip replacements or, you know, things that are not emergency.
Mm-hmm.
So that helps. But there's patient care that must continue even in a situation like this. There's still going to be patients getting cancer treatment. There's still going to be women giving birth to babies and mm-hmm. possibly hemorrhaging. Or a premature infant often needs blood transfusions. In car accidents, any type of traumatic injury, all of that will continue even in a pandemic period. So hospitals have to have the blood products they need for those types of situations.
Are they expecting a surge in need with, I mean, is blood come into play a lot with the ICU care for COVID-19 patients?
We haven't seen a need for blood specifically related to the COVID-19 patients.
Okay.
So it's not that they need the blood.
Yeah.
It's that all their other patients will continue to need the blood for the essential medical care. You know, like I said, some things can be postponed. Some surgeries can be put on hold. But if you have a friend in a car accident later today and they need blood, we want to know that blood's going to be available. And right now, not enough people are giving.
If you have a question or comment for my guest, Rodney Wilson, Communications Manager for the American Red Cross in Central Ohio, he's told us that there's been 7,000 blood drives that have been canceled. I'm sorry, is that in Ohio or nationwide?
7,000 across the country than 700 here in Ohio.
And 700 plus in Ohio, that means they need blood. They always need blood, but now it's an urgent need for all types of blood. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Should people be worried about contracting the virus from donating? Is that what it is, or is it just because they've been called off?
I think a lot of people are just they're listening to the guidance that's being provided by national and state leadership, which is to stay home. That's good advice, and we want people to do that. But our national and state leadership is also giving the advice that if you are healthy and you can give blood, you're needed to give blood now, and you're encouraged to do that. And the Red Cross, of course, has taken many measures to ensure that blood drives are clean, safe, sterile environments. You know, we have regular protocols all the time that we have in place. But in addition to our standard protocols, we've implemented all of these additional safety measures. So, you know, we want the public to know that you do not need to worry about giving blood or receiving blood in this time. We want people to feel safe at a blood drive, and we've taken the measures to do that. But also, if you end up in the hospital, maybe you're in an accident and you need blood, we want you and your family to rest assured that the medical professionals have those resources available to them. You know, a kind of the worst-case scenario that we can think of is if a doctor's looking at two patients who need a blood transfusion, we don't want that doctor to have to prioritize and decide which one gets it if there's not enough available.
Let's see. Matt in Columbus, you're on the air with Rodney Wilson of the American Red Cross in Central Ohio. Hi, Matt.
Hi. I heard this morning that convalescent plasma is being looked at to help with patients before a vaccine is available. That would probably require an antibody test to tell whether the plasma was active. Is the Red Cross going to be involved in that kind of process?
I haven't heard that the Red Cross will be involved in that process so far. I think that that's something that has to be tested, of course, and we haven't seen any of the testing come through on that. So I guess more information to come on that.
Well, what about testing for antibodies of COVID-19 anyway? I mean, is that something you're screening for?
We don't currently have a test for that. So respiratory viruses are generally not transmissible by blood transfusion. So the Red Cross tests for things that you could potentially contract by a blood transfusion, and respiratory viruses aren't in that list. So we don't have any tests for respiratory viruses.
Okay, Matt, thank you for that call. Zachary in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Zachary.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
I just had a question. I was listening, and of course, as everything's changing, you know, I'm a registered nurse, and, you know, I'm always thinking of things I can do to help since I am permitted out on the streets, seems pretty much carte blanche because I drive around Columbus. Last I knew, and I'm a homosexual, last I knew, we weren't able to donate blood based on regulation. So my question, I guess, would be, is that true still? And then if it's true, are they looking at possibly removing that restriction to help with this crisis?
Rodney Wilson, what is the regulation regarding, I guess it's mostly gay men, isn't it?
Yeah, the FDA sets the guidelines, so the eligibility criteria for blood donation. And currently the FDA does have a regulation in place for male-to-male sex. So it used to be a lifetime deferral if you've had male-to-male sex. That was changed a few years ago to be a 12-month deferral, which moved it to be in line with other sexual health deferrals. So there are other ones besides male-to-male sex.
What do you mean by deferral? You mean like they're banned from donating blood?
Yeah, a deferral is a wait period. So it would be a 12-month wait period from the last point of sexual contact. So that is currently in place with the FDA. You know, the FDA sets those eligibility criteria, all of their eligibility criteria, based on the research that they do and the medical data that they gather. And I know I've been asked from different people about different eligibility requirements to ask, you know, will there be some relaxing of the eligibility requirements because of the coronavirus situation? You know, as far as we know, the FDA, they do regularly change the eligibility requirements. We get changes to them every few months even. But those changes are all based on medical research and data that they gather. So, you know, any changes that would be coming would have to come through their research channels.
Well, Zachary, thanks for being a nurse and being out there helping people. Appreciate it. And hope that answered your question. Let's see. Pat in Worthington, you're on the air. Hi, Pat.
Hi. I just have a quick question, too. As far as eligibility, I'm a pretty long non-Hodgkin's lymphoma survivor. So with blood cancers, I didn't know. I've been getting different answers as to whether or not I could donate.
Yeah, that's a good question. So there are different deferrals or wait periods for blood donation, depending on the types of cancer that you had. Some cancers, once you've been cleared, you can give blood. Other cancers, you can't. So it just depends on the kind. And the best way to figure out, you know, what if you are eligible yourself would be to call us at 1-800-RED-CROSS, and you can talk with staff members who can, you know, do an individual assessment on you and your own medical history to determine your eligibility.
Pat, thanks a lot for that great question. Let's see. Rick in Columbus, you're on the air with Rodney Wilson of the American Red Cross. Hi, Rick.
Oh, I was just wondering about age limit. Do they have a cutoff on age? Like, I'm older 65, but as far as I know, in good health, how do they screen for that?
Yeah. Oops, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut
young
you off.
Young adults, but yeah. That's not me.
Okay. what about that, Rodney?
Yeah, no upper age limit. You can donate blood starting at 16 years old with a signed parental consent form, and then there's no upper age limit. So we just ask that you be in general good health, feeling well, a minimum of 110 pounds. And then when you go to a blood drive, there's a number of other eligibility criteria that you walk through with the staff members to determine your eligibility. But we have donors who are in their 90s. I think I've seen a donor who was 100 years old giving wow. blood. As long as you're healthy, you can give blood.
Rick, thanks a lot for that call. What about people with hepatitis? Do they, like A or B or C, can they donate blood and then that's reserved for people with hepatitis?
Similarly with cancer, I think some types you're not able to give blood and other types you are able to. So you know, the best way to figure out your own individual eligibility on that would be to call the 1-800-RED-CROSS number and our experts can walk that through with you.
What about hepatitis, people who've been cured of hepatitis C now?
Yeah, I don't know exactly which hepatitis strands are make you eligible or ineligible, but you know, our team that you can call at 1-800-RED-CROSS would be able to determine that.
Okay. Well, Rodney Wilson, thanks for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
It's Rodney Wilson. He is communications manager for the American Red Cross in Central Ohio. Coming up, we're going to talk about what your office should look and feel like to make your day more productive and to help you with mental health. So this is particularly interesting in light of so many people working from home. So if you have any questions about that, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Work can be very rewarding, but the wrong work environment can take a toll on mental health. Depression and anxiety are responsible for an estimated $1 trillion in lost productivity per year around the world. That's according to the World Health Organization. There's now a movement to design offices that help employees de-stress with spaces that offer respite from the daily grind. Mark Bryan is an interior designer at Columbus-based MA Architects, where he leads the firm's research and innovation team. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
What is the relationship between workplace stress and office design? Is it a correlation or is there actually a causation?
So there are some things both in the built environment that affect people. You know, when we talk about acoustics, we talk about maybe even too much lighting. So I think those are part of the things that affect us in the built environment. But then there's also just the things that we're dealing with in our daily life, from constant bombardment of email to constant floating from meeting to meeting and trying to be prepared for each of those meetings in between. So it's a little bit of both.
So it's a little bit of both. And the productivity, when we talk about $1 trillion in productivity around the world, what's not getting done?
I think it's just people are dealing with too much input, and so they are either taking longer to do the same tasks that they might have to because they're constantly interrupted to their – your brain, when it gets interrupted from a task, usually takes another 15 minutes to get back to that task, whatever it was. If you're in a deep dive of detailing something out and you get a call or you get an email that you answer right then you have to take time to get back to where you were.
But how do we change that with interior – layout, interior design?
Well, I think if we think about it from an actual layout standpoint, we need to make sure that we're designing spaces that allow for breaks and allow for privacy, both acoustically and visually. And then we're also allowing people to have moments where they can go in and take a break. I think that's one of the biggest things that we encourage people to do and why we're designing actually respite rooms that allow us to have mindful moments that can build some resiliency back into ourselves to deal with the challenges that we face on a daily basis.
I grew up in the journalism business in big newsrooms where there was no cubicles, no nothing open. And that's just the way it is. That's the way you have to communicate. You need to be able to look up and yell at somebody. So there's different needs for different kinds of offices, right?
Absolutely. Our office, we have very much an open plan where our panels are lower, and that's because it works for our style of work. Now, what I would also say is that we also have spaces for people to go and work in who do work differently. And that's a lot of what we're also looking into is like what people need in order to be the most productive. So it's no longer just a one-size-fits-all solution. It is more about trying to figure out how we can create different types of spaces based off of how people work best.
So I've heard that open floor plan with respite spaces is also less expensive for businesses.
Well, it all depends. Yes, there can be certain costs for that. I think right now a lot of people, yes, the open office can provide less built costs. And then the respite spaces can actually be something that are simple, that are easy to implement, that allow people to, again, go and take those breaks. And it doesn't have to be anything fancy. We do have some design that we have come up with from research and looking into design psychology from color to lighting. And these are all just simple solutions that you can implement into a workspace to help people feel less stress, less chronic stress.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about your workspace with Mark Bryan. He's an interior designer at MA Architects here in Columbus. And talking about the relevance and how the relationship between your work environment and productivity and mental well-being. If you have a question or comment about your workspace, you can throw it out to Mark Bryan, and he can tell you what he knows from the research. 614-292-8513. Or email us at allsides@wosu.org. What does color have to do with all of this?
Color could play a great factor into stress. There are certain colors that naturally calm the brain, and some of them make sense because they're more rooted in nature, and nature does great things to our bodies. And so, things like your blues and your greens are naturally going to be more calming colors, where some of your more like yellows and reds are your more activated colors. And so depending on what type of activity you want to happen in the space, you might want to be conscious what color you're selecting to go in there. Even from how bright that color is, how saturated color is, to if it wants to be something deeper or darker to bring the mood down just a little bit.
Sometimes places want to do colors that are part of their brand, that kind of a thing. How do you kind of navigate that issue?
So it's all about doing the right thing in the right location. We very much advocate for brand, because branding is really important. It helps tell a story. We've got a great experiential team who work with bringing out the pieces and parts that can create a touch point to tell that story of a company's culture and vision and values. And so we want that. We encourage that. However, it's okay to take a break from that because that allows, again, just a separation. And even that simple separation allows for people to feel recharged and be able to step back into their work office environment.
Let's talk about respite rooms a little bit. What do you mean by that? How big are they? What do they look like?
Well, so right now we are piloting singular use respite rooms, meaning just for one person. We are looking into communal respite rooms for more than one person. But for right now, what we're looking at is a small space, maybe a 6 feet by 8 feet space potentially. And it's just enough room that allows one person to come in. We typically want to put some lounge furniture in there. So maybe that's a sofa or a settee. We want to be able to provide a counter that they can put some sensory tools on. But we also want to be able to allow space if they want to stretch, if they want to do a yoga pose. They can use the room how it needs to be. So it's not very big, but it definitely, you want to make sure that you have the right color in there. Lighting is key. We look at a lot at terms of from Biophilia, which is bringing the nature into the built environment, how dappled lighting can actually help calm the central nervous system because it goes back to our reptilian brain back on that Serengeti plane, sitting underneath a tree and feeling a sense of a shelter. So there's just simple tools that you can create in that small respite space that's all designed to help calm the central nervous system, allow you to have a 10 to 15 minute break to just, again, build resiliency in yourself.
What do you mean by sensory tools?
So there are a lot of things that actually calm the brain. So there are things like essential oils. There are essential oils that just naturally calm the brain, like lavender. We have, excuse me, eye masks, because reducing light actually helps to calm the brain. We have weighted blankets that deep touch pressure releases oxytocin into the body, which helps calm you down. Even coloring. So we've got coloring books in there that allow people to have a little bit of fun in their day. And even that has been shown to help calm the central nervous system.
I love the dappled lighting idea, and I love the weighted blankets and coloring books. But I'm wondering, are employers responding to this? Because I can see a few hard-nosed people going, are you kidding me? I mean, what? So what's the response been?
We've had to do a lot of upfront education, which makes sense because there is a stigma around taking a break in the office. And once we show them the data, though, once we show them like how happier employees are more productive, how when employees are more engaged and they feel like they've had something given to them, they, again, are more productive, they start to buy into it. Now, what we've also been developing is a survey that can help define what stress looks like within the different offices, because it's all different depending on how you're working, what your demographic looks like. And this helps us to then figure out which tools to implement into a space. And so we're actually piloting that on a couple projects right now and hope to be gathering data to be able to write a white paper on it later this year.
You're a certified futurist. What is
that?
That
is correct, yes.
What is that? What does that have to do with what you're doing? I mean, or does it have nothing to do with it? I don't know.
Well, I think a futurist is really somebody who's looking at what's happening today and yesterday, taking all of the things that are happening from a social, ecological, environmental, political, even value standpoint, and looking at those signals and drivers to figure out what the potential outcomes could be. And with that, it plays really well into respite when we think about especially how we're dealing with the coronavirus right now and how we're dealing with having to self-isolate. I think there's things that I'm looking toward of what that means for the future of the office and what that means for the future of the respite space within that office environment.
So I'm glad you brought up the coronavirus because I'm curious. So many people are working from home now or not. It depends on how well they work from home, you know? I mean, not
yep.
everybody works the same way because not everybody's necessarily set up the same way. What are your recommendations, if you don't mind, for people who are at home, how they can fix things up a little bit?
Well, the first thing that I might suggest is defining what your space looks like and then defining some boundaries. You know, oftentimes we've got people who are working at home now with kids. They're taking care of kids. They're both being a worker, an employee, and a teacher. And so setting up a boundary of this is when I'm in this space or this zone, this is my work time, and trying to create that sense of a separation. I would also say creating a place where you can look outside. You know, we want to try to get light into our bodies, but we also want to make sure that we're not overly lit because that can also cause some anxiety. Trying to set up your workspace so that people aren't playing around in the peripheral of your vision because that also puts us into hyperarousal states. You know, and taking a break. It's okay to go outside and for 5 minutes. Just right now we've got sunshine in Columbus, which is a rare occurrence during this time. So I plan on getting outside and absorbing some of that vitamin D into my system and then coming back into my little work zone.
Are you concerned about knowing what you do know about the research, concerned about all the people working at home right now, you know, maybe just drag their laptop home and that's kind of all they have going for them?
In terms of their well-being
yeah.
or in terms of their productivity?
Well, both, I suppose, but I'm thinking about well-being right now.
Sure. So from a well-being standpoint, I've noticed a lot more people who are reaching out and connecting through just the laptop. You know, we at our office have a chat going that is a constant feed of connectivity. And I think things like that are important for people to be able to do. You know, if you live alone, it would be good to maybe consider there are a bunch of apps out there that allow you to connect with people that could just be up and running. So it's almost like having the office beside you, but you can choose when you want to jump into a conversation and when you want to jump out. So I think finding your own ways of how you connect best is still something that's important.
I wanted to go back to the issue of respite rooms. One of the things that are included in them, or it can be a piece of this, is curving lines. So you've already mentioned soft lighting, but you said curving lines. And I've seen kind of furniture created that way, too, that's considered sort of respite, get away from it all kind of furniture for offices. What is it about curving lines?
So there have been studies that show that actual angular forms create partial anxiety in the brain. And so that curvilinear form is, because the thought process is that at a right angle, you can't necessarily see what's coming around the corner, versus in a curved space, you would be able to see further off into the distance. And so that just gives a little bit of sense of relief. But I think the curvilinear form in itself, so in our respite room, we have a curvilinear form of a pendant that actually provides dappled lighting as well. So it serves as both functions, because we do have a rectangular room. But I think you can implement other things that help bring that curvilinear shape to the space.
And what about, I mean, how many respite rooms are there for your company? Because how many do you need? Is there a waiting room? Do you have to take a number or what?
So we have just one. We have an office about 80 here in Columbus, and then I think we're about 20 down in our Cincinnati office. And we've got one up in Columbus, and we're building one in our Cincinnati office right now. So what we have found is that, A, we had to do, again, some upfront education with our staff to make them feel comfortable using it. And then what we've told them is to try to do no more than 15 to 20 minutes, because that's all it takes you to bring you down from the most hyper-arousal state, which would be like a panic attack. And so what we found is actually that people honor that, and they go in, they use the room for what they need to, and then they leave. But it is used quite frequently throughout the day.
Hmm. How do you know that? I mean, do people sign in and out, that kind of a thing, or how do you keep track?
Ironically, it happens usually when we're bringing folks around, when we're touring people through our space and we want to show them the room. We find that usually it's there. I know that I pass it on my way to and from going out into the elevators and going out of the office, and the door is usually shut with a sign up that says somebody's using the space.
Okay.
So it's more of just we haven't done any actual data research, and that's kind of like what our next step is with some of the projects that we're implementing right now.
And just, we only have about a minute, but I wanted to know if you had any advice for people who are stuck in traditional offices without these amenities. Any suggestions for them?
I think starting to just create a program where you create safe space for people to say, I'm going to take a 10 to 15 minute break, and know that that is what they're doing in that area. So maybe if you've got a cafe space, it's just known that if you're in this section, this is your quiet zone, and there people are trying to take a break. Because I think that break allows us to just be better, better humans, better at communicating, better at speaking with each other, and better at doing our jobs.
Mark Bryan, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Mark Bryan is an interior designer at MA Architects. We've been talking about the relationship between the office design and workplace stress and productivity today. It's part of Wellness Wednesday. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.